Hello everyone and welcome along to a very special episode of Under the Abbey Stand. This is our second episode in our series of specials looking at big social issues and their relationship with football. Looking specifically at the thoughts of fans, players, pundits and managers associated with Cambridge United to find out their thoughts and feelings, but also how they think we can treat these issues going forward. Last year we released the mental health special in partnership with Shout, and this year we're delighted to be releasing a special looking at sexism and violence against women and girls within the football space, as well as what footballs can do to prevent violence against women and girls. My name is Julian Roberts, and this episode was produced alongside Holly Saunders, who is not only a long-time friend of the pod, but has worked in the movement to end violence against women and girls for a number of years, and is now looking specifically at football's relationship with the subject matter. And maybe more importantly, she's a United fan too, so she has a unique perspective for putting this pod together. She'll be taking you through the subject and guiding us through the variety of contributors who kindly took part in this episode. Big thank you to Mark Bonner, Harrison Dunk, Max Rushton, Stewie Baker and Anuska Wright for their time. So to start off, you might ask, why now? Why is this the time to release this pod? Well, on the day of release, the 1st of December 2023, we're around halfway through the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, a global campaign that kicked off on the 25th of November, which is International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and runs until the 10th of December, Human Rights Day. Since 1991, this has been an organising strategy by individuals and organisations to call for the prevention and elimination of violence against women and girls all around the world. This year's 16 days of action is specifically focused on prevention. After a year where it feels like gender-based violence stories surrounding football have been constantly in the news, with seemingly little progress, it felt like the right time to look introspectively at what happens at Cambridge United, and more importantly, maybe, what we could all do more of. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Holly.
Hello everyone, my name is Holly. Before we begin, I would just like to thank UTAS for platforming this issue and creating a space where a much-needed conversation can start. I've been working in the movement to end male violence against women for the best part of a decade. I've worked directly with victims and survivors, I've worked with schools on delivering prevention programmes, I've trained professionals, and I currently manage a service in North London supporting women and girls at high risk of domestic violence and homicide. I'm also a Cambridge United fan and have been attending games since I was a young girl. It's important for me to recognise that some may feel I'm misplaced to be speaking on this issue in the context of football, mostly because I am a woman. I'm not for 1 minute sitting here saying football causes violence against women and girls, and I would contest anyone that does. But there is a correlation, and we need to talk about it. I can see how football clubs are incredibly well placed to tackle this issue and be a catalyst for positive change, and that will be the focus of this pod. It's also important for me to say that we will be focusing on women being victims and survivors. It is not to say that this does not happen to men. It is, however, women who are disproportionately victims of domestic and sexual violence, and it is for that reason they are my area of focus. For the most part, you'll be hearing male voices on this podcast, and that is for a reason, which we will shortly get to. However, before we move to that, it felt important to speak to Anuska Wright, one of the founders of Amber Bells, female fan group at Cambridge United, to understand the experiences of women in the footballing arena and what women might need more of.
Amber Bells come about after a discussion with Dave Matthews-Jones, who's the supporter liaison officer at Cambridge United. He suggested that maybe there should be a female fan group within it. We wanted to create a space where female fans, if they wanted to, had a place where they could discuss the games, discuss any issues that they had, and just have a face to talk to. I think the misconception sometimes is that a female fan group is set up to be against men almost, but it's not. It's to just support the women that don't feel they can go to games on their own, or they don't feel they can speak out. But we're not trying to say, right, this is just for women. You know, men can join the Facebook groups, they can get involved in the chat as long as they're respectful, same as any group. Last year we did a female fans forum, which got some stick, as predicted. It wasn't massively well attended. There was only about 10 to 15 people there. As we said, it got some stick, like, how much is this costing the club? Why are they doing that? Why is there not a man's fans forum? Blah, blah, blah. We're not trying to divide. There's none of that. It's just, and I think the same when it was first announced that the women's team were going to play at the Abbey. They're like, well, that's a waste of money. You know, why are they doing that? It's such a positive thing. The club are really doing a lot, I think. They've created a female board as well. They've fully integrated the women's team into the club. They've played some games at the Abbey. It's all good. Like, there's a lot of positivity coming out of the club at the minute, I think. And thankfully, what I really liked about the when we did the female fans forum was that I didn't comment on anything. It would have been really easy to, bite back at some of the comments, but I just left them all. I didn't get involved. But there was men saying they're doing it because of people like you, or they're doing it because, like, they need a voice as well. Like, what's wrong? Like, what is the problem? How does this affect you? So that was really nice to see. And I think that's something we need to go down the road of, like, challenging behaviors. It's really good to see men challenging sexism or any racism, whatever it is, but particularly sexism. I think it's really good when you see man just go, no, that's wrong. And that's what I'd like to see more of, I think.
Unfortunately, it won't be a surprise to hear that such a simple thing as a female fans forum got comments like that. Really, you only have to look online at the responses women get when talking about football compared to men. Women are typically disparaged and criticised, and men's opinions hold worth and value. It was, of course, encouraging to hear that at Cambridge United there were men amongst the fan group challenging those comments made to Anoushka. It was a pleasure to speak with Cambridge United legend Harrison Dunk, who clearly agreed football should be a place for all rather than male dominated.
I think, I mean, the fact that this is even a question is sort of crazy in my eyes. I think football is a family event and sport. It's something that needs to be enjoyed. It's not just a man's sport. I mean, sad reality is that many probably perceive it in that way. But I think it's amazing to see, for example, the women's game growing so much, and I think that will have a positive impact.
Let's take a step back from United for a second and look at why we are talking about sexism and violence against women in football more widely. Let's look at that correlation I've mentioned and the prevalence of violence against women in the footballing arena. We know domestic violence goes up on match days. We know that there are players and management accused or convicted of crimes against women who remain in their jobs or playing for their teams. We know misogyny occurs in the terraces in many forms, and we will talk to these points later. But first, let's open this discussion. I want to understand how clubs could engage on the issue within their clubs and community, and whether the media has a role to play in opening up the conversation. To start, I spoke with two people who have an involvement with the two extremes of the game, the elite level that Max Rushton works on daily, but firstly, Stewie Baker, who runs local grassroots social media channel Squeeze.
I would like it to be a situation where it's spoken about. I feel like it's a bit of a taboo subject. Like the games I go to, like the crowds are like in their hundreds. So it's like community focused things that maybe those kind of things wouldn't be talked about. Like almost every village, every town, every place has a football club. They all have, most of them have branches of women's team, most of them have branches of children's teams. So you think of the potential and the community focus and the potential to talk about issues. You know, these people are not full time. They don't have full time employees. It's volunteers. But then you do think about the potential, the community to engage a community in issues. And I think very much if you start from, as the old saying, an acorn can grow into a big tree. So if you have that much engagement and that much potential, it may be only hundreds at a game, but if there's several hundreds of people at several games, children, partners, and volunteers, you have such a potential base to talk about issues. And why should that not be talked about? Why should those conversations not be being had whilst you are providing a place? You can't do more, you can't have messages, you can't have things that are talked about, you can't have conversations, and you can't have those players engaged in those conversations. As I say, if you start those conversations in towns and villages, then and across the basis of the Football League pyramid, then you might start to see like there's a bit of a view coming onto non-league football now, like via YouTube and media, and everyone's talking about it a bit more. So if non-league were to engage itself in that, become a place potentially where those conversations are being had, that might encourage professional clubs, and they might see what's going on. Allyship isn't just about saying, oh, I agree with that. It's about doing more. It's about talking about it. It's about engaging with it. It's about having those conversations, because part of that is creating a safe space as well and saying, like, we have a space where you can come to, because you never know, again, like what someone may be dealing with or whatever, and if they come to a place and say, well, that is a safe place, or even if you spoke to a charity and said, you know, our football club, we'll have someone at the club on this day or that day or whatever, and someone can come along and have a cup of tea. You know, they may not be ready to take further steps, but if you create safe spaces for these people, and as I say, like, if Cambridge United were to come out and say, we can do this, and then these clubs in the community say, Histon, March, God, Manchester, we're supporting these. So if you're a Cambridge United fan, but in that community, if you live in Ely, if you live in March, Wisbeach, God, Manchester, don't come to Cambridge United. You don't have to come all that way. You may not, obviously, with the situation, you may not be able to, but we'll have these outliers. We'll have these places. Those places will have messages. Those places will be open. Those places will be talking to their youth teams. Those places will be engaging with people like yourself, and asking what they can do and responding to that. Because even if you try it and it necessarily isn't the thing that works or whatever, trying to do something is better than not doing it.
So interestingly, I've written a couple of pieces about this. One about a very high profile player who had been accused of rape, and a woman had a payout and signed an NDA, and he'd signed for a football club, and everybody had said what a great person this was. It wasn't about what a great footballer, and I was like, well, hang on a second, right? You know, there is another side to this story, you know, and it's very important to say in a lot of these cases, you know, he wasn't charged, he was never found guilty. And I found the silence sort of pretty deafening. You know, I don't see myself as some sort of pioneer in this, but, you know, from my point of view, when I write a column a fortnight and I try and do something serious and then something silly. That's what I try and do. So I'm like, this is a subject that I think is really important. I think it's a deafening silence. I think we talk about issues in the game really quite well. Some of them, like racism, we talk about, you know, we haven't solved it. It's still a massive problem. Homophobia, same. But actually misogyny and sexual and domestic violence is a sort of, it's just sort of, it's deafening, the silence.
As Max mentions, there is indeed another side to this. And it's for this reason I think it's important to talk about why men may not be convicted or charged for offences against women. To not be convicted does not necessarily mean it did not happen. Conviction rates for offences of rape are appallingly low. Of the 70 plus thousand rapes reported to the police in 21 to 22, less than 2% of those resulted in a conviction. I would say it would be misplaced to suggest that the other 98% were false allegations. In fact, the most recent study suggests false rape allegations are distinctly rare and sit around the 2% mark. When reporting rape, women have to go up against a police force we know to be inherently misogynistic. We have police officers murdering women. They have to go up against rape myths and reckon with their own shame and guilt. Arguably misplaced, the shame and guilt should be on the perpetrator. Never mind should the case make it to a charge and to trial. The woman has to be completely re-traumatised, recounting her experiences through multiple interviews, examinations and providing evidence in court. When talking about football, women also have to go up against a man with wealth, power and influence. I would ask people to consider what it must be like to be that woman in question. Be the woman who has to face countless accusations from fans adoring the player, being labelled every sexist name under the sun, being outright accused of lying, and all the while seeing the man who likely perpetrated violence against her remain respected, praised, and importantly supported by such a vast number of people. I couldn't do it.
And again, like, you're talking from such a place of privilege when you go, it's quite stressful to write about it. You know, if I write a piece about how much I love Dion Dublin and John Taylor and John Beck in the 90s, well, I can do that, my eyes closed, and when it's tweeted out, no one's going to call me a whatever. They're just going to be, isn't nostalgia great? If I write a piece about domestic violence, you do get, you know, fans of that specific player or that club absolutely hammering you. And sometimes you want, you know, and what a ridiculous, you know, like, here I am sitting here, I've never ever witnessed it, you know, I'm not going to be a victim of it. You know, you have a duty, right, to speak up for people who don't have a voice. But at the same time, sometimes you just want an easy day. And like, that's sort of the brutal reality of it, I guess. So what it needs is you know, as many people to talk about it as possible and to normalize those conversations so people don't instantly get scared when they're talking about it.
As Max mentions, I've learnt myself through producing this podcast that men find it difficult to talk about violence against women and girls, and challenging it is even worse. And whilst I hear that, and it may be difficult, we have to acknowledge how much worse it is for the woman being subjected to male violence. And just one challenge, one act of intervening from a male to another could prevent that harm. Interestingly though, men are able to talk about it in the terraces. I'm not necessarily talking about the chanting directly aimed at women, but more so the chanting directed at opposition players, managers and coaches who have had a conviction or an allegation of violence against women made against them. You don't need me to tell you what chants I'm talking about. I want to understand where that is rooted. Are those chants rooted in a care for women and a respect for their basic human right to move through the world unharmed, or is it just a case of sporting one-upmanship? I spoke to Anushka and Max about this.
And I think social media makes a big difference, doesn't it? Whenever, because football is so tribal, that what you see, and I think in one of the pieces I wrote about it, you know, there's a player who is accused of rape is being cheered by one set of fans and being booed by another set of fans. And then suddenly that set of fans have a player accused of rape and then they cheer them. So they're not, you know, it's all a pantomime. They're not actually that bothered about these things because, as with everything in football, right, the desperation for success is so much that you put in your head in the sands about who is playing for you, who owns your football club, all these kind of things.
No, I agree. I think it's totally a one-up of, like, how rubbish, you've got this, you know, embarrassing for you. And I think, you know, when you see tweets or comments or pray for so-and-so's wife or pray for so-and-so's girlfriend, they don't care about that wife or girlfriend. It's just another way to have a dig, isn't it? There's no support there at all. And it would be really interesting to know that how some of these people would react if their club employed some of the people that we see. You know, it's all very jolly and funny, isn't it, when it's a club, especially a club that you hate. But when it, if it happens in yours, how much challenge would you give the owners, or how much challenge would you put out there and support? It would, you don't see it so often. I don't know whether they would.
I guess a lot of people, you know, football is seen as the 2 hours of a week where you can escape, right? Where you can just shout what you like and let off steam and not have to worry about life, which can be pretty draining sometimes. So I'm really aware that I'm in a really privileged position where, you know, I'm paid to watch football, right? It's a total dream job. And so I'm not craving this escapism, right? But I really feel like it is just something that isn't discussed enough. And what I don't know, and you might know better, is, you know, that there is obviously, like, casual misogyny, there's chanting, there's domestic violence. You know, the stats of domestic violence goes up when football teams lose a game and things. There's quite a big, you know, that's quite a big step between those two things, but are they connected at all, right? You know, it's casual misogyny in a WhatsApp group. It's clearly not as important as domestic violence, but it is still important. And so I think that the whole subject is really fascinating, and it's just something that isn't talked about a lot.
Looking at misogyny in different contexts is needed when we're looking at football and the correlation between violence against women and girls. Group chats are a good place to focus our attention. Men do not suddenly go home one day and choose to assault their wife, partner and mother. Men do not one day have a sudden moment where they choose to sexually assault a woman on a night out. It starts somewhere. Unfortunately, from day one, men are socialised into social norms and negative attitudes towards women, just down to the society that we live in. Unfortunately, some men choose to buy into those norms and attitudes that women are for men to have power over, control, or to oppress. They are entitled to do this, such as perpetrating acts of violence against women. Group chats, pub chats, and social media can and do provide a platform for some men to exert these beliefs around women, to test the waters of what's acceptable. If these beliefs go unchallenged, I would ask, where do they stop? If a man is not challenged on a misogynistic statement in a group chat, does he then take it further and do something that makes a woman feel uncomfortable or assaulted in a pub? If he's unchallenged there, the socialised norms that women should be violated, abused, harassed are reinforced. No one has stopped him, no one has challenged him, and if no one has challenged him, it must be okay, right? Rape does not start at rape. It starts at these social norms and unchallenged social norms and negative attitudes towards women. All men have a responsibility. I often hear from people when speaking about feminism and equality that women do have equal rights. And to that I would say that women are disproportionately victims of domestic and sexual violence. The pay gap remains and women's healthcare remains vastly under-researched compared to men's, just to name a few examples. Look at the women in your life's experiences compared to your own. Such a simple thing as walking down a street in the dark at night is a task for a woman. She knows she is much more likely to be assaulted, murdered, raped by a man compared to her male counterpart. And so she makes accommodations for that. She might change her route. She might walk the longer way home because it's lit by lights. She might call a friend on her way home. And I can guarantee she'll text her friend when she gets home safe. Men don't have to do that. To look at the direct experiences of women in football grounds, Amber Bells and Her Game 2 sent UTAS some shocking stats.
From a poll conducted by female fans about their experience in stadiums, the results were that 1.7% reported experiencing physical assault, 4.2% reported experiencing sexual assault, making a total of 5.9% of women answering the poll experiencing either physical or sexual assault in football stadiums. Furthermore, in 2021, a study by the Football Supporters Association, the FSA, found that 20% of women attending matches have experienced unwanted physical attention. It's also important to note that there are far more reports that come to Her Game 2 and the Amber Bells, mainly secondhand, that don't become official reports. This is largely due to fear or assumptions that nothing will be done to the perpetrators, which sadly reflects what happens in wider society. In addition to Her Game 2's reporting system on our website, most of the 92 clubs in England have their own reporting system too, but we do not have the report data from Cambridge United available to us.
Knowing that such offences occur in grounds, and knowing that men can make a real difference both inside and outside of football grounds, with football clubs being the catalyst for this change, football clubs could look at it as an opportunity to be able to make a real tangible difference to preventing violence against women and girls. This is something I spoke to Dunk and recently departed United manager Mark Bonner about. Of course, it goes without saying, at time of recording, Bonner was still manager, but despite his recent departure, his thoughts remain representative of the wider ethos at Cambridge United.
I think as a club, I've been at the club now 12 years, and I think there's always been a focus on the community aspect and helping the community in whatever way they can. I think that's definitely has advanced and progressed over the years, and it's sort of more widespread and wide-reaching in the areas that it's covering. For example, an area, a topic such as this wouldn't have been covered when I first came to the club. It was more in the racism part and other areas such as that. So it's amazing that topics like this are now being sort of brought to the brought to a head and discussed. And we did a campaign last year in related to it, and so it's amazing that it's now becoming a focus to football clubs and in the community.
So I do think there is a real desire for change, and people are understanding that this environment is for everybody. And you can come to Cambridge United at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon to watch the men's team play, right? There are going to be 6,000 or 7,000 people there, people from every demographic possible. And we want that crowd to be as diverse as possible and celebrate the difference between people. But the reason everybody's there is they're for the same reason, supporting the same thing. So we've actually got more about us that's similar than is different. And I think it's recognizing that and almost shouting that from the rooftops and making it a really environment that people want to be part of. And understanding that, yeah, look, things have got better, but they're not perfect in any area. And that's what we have to keep working to improve. And football clubs can definitely help because they're powerful tools to put out social messages, for sure.
Anything that, the world isn't obviously a great place at the moment. And I think there's terrible things happening. And so I think any change that is positive and could happen and might make even the tiniest inch of difference is something that needs to be sort of encouraged. And of course, I think I'd like to think most everyone at the club would want to educate themselves on this and proactively try and help. The power and influence clubs now have is sort of amazing. Social media is obviously growing exponentially, and with that comes a great responsibility of clubs. And it's important. I mean, I wouldn't even say it's important. I'd say it's a necessity that clubs kind of use that power for the good and make change, because without change, nothing will happen. Without sort of raising the awareness, nothing will happen and no change will sort of occur. And so I think basically it's just a responsibility to educate people. And if the club can do that using their sort of platform they have, that's definitely something they should do.
Certainly not a subject that I would say I am comfortable speaking in, but actually you only learn in uncomfortable situations. And so that's why I'd be quite happy to have those discussions and work out, right, how can we make a difference here? You have to understand that with the territory comes this element of being a role model. People want to hear what you've got to say, and you can have a powerful message with what you say, and you can influence people and help educate people along the way. And sometimes your opinion people won't agree with, and that's fine. But if you have one, you should say it, and you should use that platform for good if you can. And I think that any sort of platform we can get behind to try to say, look, number one aim for us day to day is try and put a team on the pitch that can entertain people and win football matches. But actually, we have a huge ability to make an impact in a massive and wonderful city, whether at whatever age and whatever part of society that is. We should try and use that platform the best we can so that people feel educated when they're out in the real world and behave well, and we make our city better. But we make our football club somewhere people want to come and want to be part of and feel part of. And so whatever social group they come from, whatever demographic they're from, we all have a synergy in it, something we share. We're all part of the same club playing under that badge when we come together. That's what we're trying to build. And while any of us are in these positions and at the club, we have a responsibility to try and help that.
Football clubs engaging their fans and communities on this issue is certainly one area of focus that can help prevent violence against women and girls. It was a pleasure to hear Bonner and Dunk speak so positively on the matter. Another area that came up during interviews was the role of academies. Academies are incredibly well placed to talk with boys on this issue from a young age. They can interrupt those social norms and attitudes men buy into, and they can support boys to feel more comfortable talking about it and therefore challenging it. Importantly, it is one thing to reprimand those who do commit offences against women, but it is also another thing to be part of the wheels of change that stop it from happening in the first place. Prevention needs to start at the cause, not only after it has happened. Arguably, a whole club approach would benefit women and girls immensely. Let's hear from all of our speakers on the academy systems and how they can help.
So I guess you've got two things here, right? You've got fans and their behaviour, and you know, fans getting angry when their team loses and taking it out on their partner and stuff, you know, which is sort of inconceivable to think is a thing that happens, but it does. And then you have players, right? And if you're thinking from a player's perspective, what a weird environment that you're in in men's football, where it's alpha, it's testosterone. There are virtually zero women in positions of authority. You are the kings of the place. So any women who are at a training ground are, you know, there are some coaches, very few managers, some physios, but really that the power imbalance is huge compared to most people's workplaces. And so there is a duty of care that football academies definitely have. But, you know, so do parents and schools and everything, to like talk to men about consent, about domestic violence, about all those things. I wonder if a club thinks, you know, these are our responsibilities and these aren't. What are our main responsibilities? You know, make a player better at football, you know, get them in the first team, sell them for money, whatever. That's what we're here to do. We're not here to give them A-levels. We're not here to, you know, turn them into lovely people. But actually, that sort of is what you should be doing, especially at academy level, right? Because how few footballers actually make it as a footballer, right? You want these people to leave. And you know, on a wider point, when you look at how many people fail from academies or don't make it as footballers, really a lot of those players are being sold a false dream, right? They're sort of there so the really good players can have someone to train with. And then you go, when they're 16, 17, raising, go, oh, cheers, mate, see you later. And actually, so you really do have a responsibility, but you can understand why a club has finite resources and finite time and thinks, well, okay, what are the things that really matter for us to be successful? It's a depressing way to look at it, but I suspect that is part of it.
So if we're talking about grassroots, it also encompasses youth football, and hundreds of children are involved in youth football, and that tends to be an area where at that age, you get to, like, as from like maybe 6 to 16, so you get to an age where children may not be interested in football in the future, but at that point you have a really captive audience. And I know they go to school and they're taught things as well, but coaches, grassroots coaches, volunteers, they do such amazing work on sort of helping kids and their social skills and things like that. And what you say is spot on, because if you were having those conversations at that level, obviously in terms of, you know, you're engaging with children, but if you had those conversations with boys clubs, with young men, because even if you were having those conversations with youth football clubs, then they'd be going out into the world when they're 16 going, oh, well, I'm not interested in football, I don't play it anymore. But they've brought me up to have these conversations to know what's acceptable to speak about it.
Firstly, having been academy manager, worked in academies for 15 years, like the work that is being undertaken in academies to try to upskill young men's life skills and holistic development is like bigger than ever. And the responsibility and pressure, I think, on football clubs and academies is like bigger than it's ever been. Not only have you got to try to produce footballers, young footballers that can go on and have a career, there is so many other things. There is such a weight towards academic education provision and then social skills, life skills, important social messages. But it's certainly an area I think that can be spoken about, because in the end, what academies are, it's a school for teaching people how to survive in the real world and how to behave in the real world and so on.
I think you've got that audience there. You know, there might be some embarrassment around it from their part. There might be some awkward discussions that they've never had before and had never had in a public space before. But I think it would be an amazing idea to get people in and make it a program, because I'm sure that in the academies they have, you know, they'll have their mental health training, they'll have their media training or whatever else. Put that in as a point. Like, this is the booklet of how you how things are when you're in our academy, and these are the things that you're going to learn about.
Look, in a perfect world, every academy would have to do all manner of training, right, for their players. You know, what you want is to develop these footballers, especially the ones who've sort of left education, right? And you'd want it in schools as well. When I think about, I was never taught anything at school, you know, the shit you don't learn at school, which you think, why are we never given that, you know, just that piece of information that would be useful rather than, you know, how suspension bridges were made or something, you know? And so, yeah, in a perfect world, there is enough funding from the FA or from the PFA, PFA have a lot of money, or from the Premier League or wherever it may be, to say, actually, here is our duty of care for the players that aren't going to make it, the players at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You want to come and train with us? Well, you have to do X, Y, and Z. But until it's consistent, then it won't happen. But yeah, I think it's a really, really brilliant idea. I mean, and that shouldn't just be about teaching them about consent and domestic violence and sexual violence. It should be teaching them about racism and homophobia and like everything within the game, you know, all the problems that are within the game, but within society as well.
Max makes an excellent point here. Academies can and do work with boys on issues within the game and within society as well. My question would be, if we know that violence against women and girls is an issue in the game and in wider society, football clubs are incredibly well placed to be part of the prevention due to the male-dominated space and influence over male fans in the community. So why is there not funding to do this work with young boys in academies, or why do clubs not engage on the issue? The Premier League now has a mandatory requirement for clubs to complete sexual consent training, yet only half have done so. Harrison spoke to us on how things have progressed in terms of engaging on the matter and the role of academies to take this further.
I mean, it's hard to say because I'm an old man now, so I am not 100% sure on how the academy system works in respect to the education and in topics like this. From my experience when I was younger, it wasn't spoken about. There wasn't that sort of education. And I think that's maybe reflected society at that time. And that's not to say society's moved on with an unbelievable amount, but the fact that we're even having this conversation, I don't think that would have happened 15, 16 years ago. And so I feel like there's obviously a long way to go. And I think academies are the stepping stone, because education at young levels and at a young age is always going to be sort of the answer. And ensuring that children do understand how important it is, what the repercussions are, make it, I wouldn't say interesting, but make it so that they can understand it and they are interested in it, they want to make change and help.
The idea of role models has come up a few times, naturally, in this conversation. It just makes a lot of sense for players to engage on the issue, as well as the clubs. There is a mutual respect there, and influence, between fans and their club. If players spoke about violence against women and girls, would their fans engage? Would they respect that? Would they appreciate it? I wanted to see what Dunk made of it, and whether it's something he thinks about, but also from Stewie on how even grassroots players and the clubs can be role models in a different way.
I mean, when you step back, then you maybe consider that you are a role model, but I mean, the nature of lower league football, you could say, I wouldn't really consider myself a massive idol. But then at the same time, I mean, I grew up watching QPR in the same league as we're in now, and I used to idolise those players, copy their boots, copy their haircuts, whatever that might be. And so when I reflect, I do realise that we are, of course, sort of role models, and obviously with that comes a responsibility that you need to sort of be that positive role model and ensure that if people are going to copy your behaviour, it has to be a good behaviour to copy.
And in terms of tackling violence against women and girls itself, like, we can all do more in those clubs. If someone in a village or a town sees their local club saying, this isn't acceptable, we're not going to welcome it, and they start speaking on it, then regardless of someone, if they don't even go to the football, if they see that one of the pillars of their community, which these football clubs are, then it's a good way to start conversations as well. I think what worries me as well is, like, I live in fairly rural Cambridgeshire, right? So there are people with attitudes that aren't necessarily, you don't agree with and you don't like. And we regard these opinions as old school, quite quaint, as like they're old men, whatever. But you're saying that about a 16-year-old, and you read about these people on social media, and these people have such a platform. And I know people who work in schools with young men, and they're saying that these points of view are coming out. They're vocalising themselves. They're not infrequent. It's a thing that's happening. Men are being, you know, having those opinions.
So we've spoken about how football clubs can be well placed to make a difference, both in their community and in their own ranks. Some may ask, why is it the focus on men's football and men's spaces that is important? Why are we hearing mostly men's voices on this podcast? Typically, this is an issue addressed by women for women, but that is exactly my point. I've worked in this area for nearly a decade. I've worked with hundreds of women who have very similar experiences. All of these women have been subjected to either domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking, harassment, exploitation. In those 10 years, I have not seen a single bit of change. I have not seen a reduction in violence against women and girls. A woman is killed every 3 days by a man in the UK, and that statistic has not changed since the femicide census started counting dead women in 2009. In fact, we saw with COVID that domestic violence specifically increased. And I can tell you that as a woman who was working for a charity supporting women in Cambridgeshire subjected to domestic violence during the COVID pandemic, and the need for our work and support increased. Nothing is changing, and now I want to focus on why is that, and who can help. Women have been supporting women for decades. The first women's refuge opened in the 1970s because women organised, set it up, unpaid, as volunteers. Sadly, the need for refuges has not changed, and more women need refuges than there are available. Women will continue to support women and keep themselves and help them recover from male violence. But it is not women perpetrating these crimes, and that is why I'm now talking to the men. Not just the men perpetrating these crimes, but to all men to hold each other accountable. It is not for women to change men's behaviour, it is for men to change their behaviour. And that's why football clubs can be one of the many catalysts for change. They are so well placed to speak with men and send that message to men. Dunk and Bonner speak on this.
On that, I'd say it's also a responsibility of men at the game. I mean, it shouldn't be a responsibility just of a woman to report this sort of thing. I think it's sort of a responsibility of men as a whole to sort of stand up to that behaviour if they see or hear it. And so it shouldn't just be up to a woman to have to go through whatever procedure that might or might not be in place. It should be a an environment that just ensures that behaviour doesn't happen in the first place, or, and if it does, it can crack down on it straight away.
And I also really aware of the irony of men standing speaking about how women might feel at football matches. Like, how do I know? I don't know. I'm in the majority of the male fans that go to games. So I can't say for one moment I have any empathy of how it feels to be a young girl or a woman going to a football match. And I think being really proactive with the messaging around this is key. Incredibly reactive in any situations where things do happen, because you have to show that there is zero tolerance to all of this. And then from the, you know, in a real male dominated environment, being brave enough for that uncomfortable conversation that we've just talked about there, whether that's in our education or just calling it out when something's not right, just calling it out. And that's not easy in a male dominated environment, but it's certainly something that everyone has to try to buy into.
Yeah, I think there'll be an element that a lot of men will neglect the issue and believe that because it's not something that we experience every day, and because I'm not sure, a high percentage of men, I'd like to think, don't act in a violent way towards women. And so they probably, in a sense, subconsciously don't think about it and don't talk about it because they kind of in their own head believe it shouldn't be an issue, which it shouldn't be, but the reality is that it is. You might not think it directly affects you, or because you don't have those views, or you don't do that directly to your wife, but you never know when your wife or your whatever it might be daughter is out, or and she might experience those issues, and so that the impact is closer to home than they might think. I think, as we mentioned before, I think the accountability is massive. I think it's important that people really take a stand to such behavior. I think anyone can just see it or hear it and think, well, it's not me, so it's, I'm not being violent myself, so I'm not, it's nothing to do with me. But by not reporting it, by not stepping in and helping, it's almost as bad because you're just facilitating it. So I think that's a massive thing. I think obviously the education's huge, and I think especially in sport, there's such a sort of masculine culture. And so it's very important that whenever possible, that can be the sort of challenge any misogynistic sort of or violent thoughts or behaviours that might exist. And any, as we've always said, any chance of a change is always going to be a good thing.
So it feels quite clear, looking at the correlation between football clubs, violence against women and girls, and the impact they can have. But in the wider footballing landscape, the rise of women's football and the consequential impact on this topic has been overall a positive one. Unfortunately, though, it has left me with more concerns than I had originally thought I might have. It would make sense to see the rise of women's football as only positive for women. However, in some cases, it has made the issue of violence against women and girls in football so glaringly obvious. Firstly, though, let's look at the positives of the rise of women's football. Anushka, Bonner and Max spoke about the rise of women's football, both at Cambridge United and in the wider footballing landscape, and what they hope it might mean for future generations.
EFL have a women's weekend now, and lots of clubs do things around that. Let's just keep trying to encourage the next generation of women who I hope are going to be brought up with boys like my son, who sees no difference in whether we go and watch men's and women's football. He said to me the other day, "Mummy, who did you play for when you was little?" And I was like, "Mate, there wasn't really clubs then." And he couldn't even comprehend that there wasn't football club, that girls didn't play football as much. I was like, "We had a tournament at school, but that was it." Like, let's build on all of this positivity around women in football and hope that the generations that are coming through will have a lot better responsibility, a lot better care, and just more encouragement.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the club side, I think trying to diversify the club and bring the women's team closer to the football club as it was a bit of a standalone entity using the badge and the name in previous seasons, but to fully integrate Cambridge United Women's Football Club with Cambridge United Football Club, because they are the same thing, was an important part. And I think step one was to try to integrate the team within the club firstly, but then secondly, since then, I mean, the amount of professionalisation of that squad, the financial investment from the club, the amount of sponsorship that's been able to be obtained off the back of that. And then the collaboration with the club, but also just the setting up of almost the female women, the women's team board, having a separate board, and Jenny Horsfield leading on that, and Graham Daniels and Ben Strang in our end, and Alex Tunbridge as employees, those two. Being so engaged in the club has been a big difference, but it's about making sure that we invest, understand that the team is important and that there is a pyramid in female football that we want to climb and do as well in as the same as the men's team. So in that side of things, it's been great. And also that the community activity, the girls development centres, girls goalkeeping centres, the excellence pathway that is developing more and more in the girls' side of football in comparison to the men's academy system and the boys' academy system, making sure that there is a pathway and a team at the top that people can progress to and young girls can aspire to make it towards, I think is a really important part of having any development pathway. So it makes sense from a complete sporting perspective, but also from the point of view that actually this is a really important part of our football club, and it is more than just 3 o'clock Saturday men's team. And so we try to grow every part of it. So as a wider strategy for the club, trying to improve and develop that relationship has been important. I think it's been huge strides in the last couple of seasons. And we also, I know, see it as a starting point, which is really encouraging.
Obviously now there's a whole group of kids coming through that women's football is on TV. It's out there. They're playing at the real stadiums. They're not playing at, you know, in front of one man and a dog. They're involved. There's the appetite for women to come to football and girls to come to football is out there. Let's encourage it. Let's make it safe. Let's give initiatives. Let's do things. It's not a slight against men. It's just to encourage more fans. You know, it brings all different kinds of opportunities, especially for some clubs that don't get good attendances. You know, let's encourage it.
Don't you think as well, just for young girls in general now, if you look at like the success of the Lionesses team outperforming the men's team in major tournaments recently, and the amount of young girls that have engaged in our club, but just football in general, the number of girls that go to the additional centres. You know, not too long ago, I was running our academy system or even the community system 20 odd years ago. And you'd have girls only football camps in the summer holidays, and they would be so poorly attended. There would be so few players. But the engagement now, I think the opportunities is one, but also just the access and profile of the women's game has made a huge difference, I think. And therefore, it just gives them something they want to be part of. That just gives so many people, so many young girls, the chance to engage in a football club, whether that's their own playing or just supporting the women's team or the men's team. Like, they're engaged in football and all that brings, which I think is a real strength.
And I suppose you also hope that, and this is quite tangential, that as the women's game grows, that football clubs will, you know, and it will take a long time for there to be sort of equality in pay and all those things, if it ever happens. But as women's teams improve, and they're improving all the time and getting better and better, and more fans are going to watch them, that suddenly actually your football club, and of course they're very sort of they can be very separate entities at the same club, but the more that they sort of do things together, right, even if they're just media appearances or whatever, like that will sort of help change misogynistic attitudes, I think. Like when I was 10, girls playing football was a joke. Like, it wasn't a serious thing. And so me sort of getting into women's football as a middle-aged man is very different to my son, who hopefully will just watch football and it won't be any different.
You know, you can see that how positive football and sport can be as a powerful good. Like, you only need to look at the Women's World Cup that's just gone and the issues that a lot of those teams were facing the incredible things that those women managed to achieve in the face of all this persecution and the face of the abuse that a lot of these teams were facing, whether it's financial, emotional, physical, sexual, unfortunately. So if we can harness that in sport in its entirety in this country with things like this, with conversations, if it starts with conversations, then you will get to a point where these things become a lot easier.
So the rise of women's football and United's considered and purposeful approach to integrating the women's team is a positive and hopeful place for us to be in. I would, however, be doing myself a disservice if I did not touch on something closer to home. The rise of women's football is important, but it is not the same, and we have to talk about that. Over the past few weeks, if I look at my Twitter feed on a Sunday afternoon, I see an image of Peterborough women's team number 10, Tara Kirk, on my screen. Kirk was Borough's top goalscorer last season and is seemingly on track to do the same this season. However, whenever Borough posts on Twitter that she has scored, all you have to do is scroll through the comments below an image of her to become immediately reminded of how prevalent violence against women and girls is across the footballing arena. Kirk is subjected to comments of sexual harassment and misogyny. Men are talking about how they'd shag her, how many pints it would take for them to sleep with her, and sexualising her. Rarely do you see a comment on her footballing ability. Why is it that she doing the same job as her male counterpart in the men's team is not seen and treated the same? Why does she not get the same response as the men do? Why is it that her talent and skill is not recognised? Rather, her value is attributed to how attractive she is. Why can she not just be a woman doing well for her team? Why does she have to be subjected to sexual harassment when men aren't? Why can't she just play football? Every week, I had seen the comments getting worse, men emboldening each other to comment more and more sexist things. I was not surprised when last week Borough had to release a statement addressing and condemning the comments they were receiving, only to receive further comments sexualising Kirk. It's endless. They've now released a second statement. Men rarely comment on female ability. Rather, they comment on their appearance, which is largely how women are viewed and attributed worth in society. The more attractive, the more worth a woman has. In wider society, women are subjected to sexist comments and harassment disproportionately. They also learn that with this comes some kind of threat. Women rightly worry, and unfortunately so, about where those comments can lead to. Men do not have that worry, or at least nowhere near as much. It's for this reason, alongside many other reasons discussed in this podcast, that there has to constantly be work done to ensure that whilst women and football is on the agenda more than ever before, that it does not stop here, and that clubs engage with women in football and for women in their communities for generations to come.
I'm not educated enough to know what to say on my platform, and my platform, I've talked about mental health, and to be frank, my following is 80% men and 20% women, so I'm not sure. I know I should speak and say more. I'm not sure it would be going to the right places. I'm not sure how to frame that. I'm not sure. That's why I've reached out to you before, wanting to do more, but wanting it to be the right thing, to say the right thing, to be put in the right place at the right time, and for it to be the right message and for it to be appropriate. And I just don't see the same uproar. I don't see the same reactions. I don't see the same, you know, I just don't see that reaction on social media. I follow a lot of men, a whole range of society, from, you know, people who are quite well known to just players who've played in non-league for 20 years to players who were on committees, whatever, a whole cross-section of society. And I don't see the willingness to talk about it. I don't see it, the uproar. I don't see people challenging it. I don't see people on committees who say, right, we've got a women's team. They're brilliant. They're fantastic. Some of these women's teams are excellent. But then, you know, in terms of, and they have their safeguard leads and they have the people in the club and they do everything for women's football. I'm not saying they don't, but then they don't take the next step. So they are allies in that they do everything they have to do. They support the women's clubs. They celebrate the women when the women do well and everything else. But then you don't see the next step. You don't see those posters that we've talked about. You don't see the men's clubs saying this is unacceptable.
That point by Stewie on men's clubs saying it's unacceptable is the key. Women's clubs and teams are hugely important, but the male clubs must take the lead on taking a stand. I went to the women's finalissima at Wembley this year. Before the game started, both teams took to the centre of the pitch and held up a banner stating that they stood with survivors of sexual violence. I was standing there thinking this is excellent. There's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of women at Wembley who have been subjected to sexual violence, and they are going to see that the England women's team recognise that and stand with them. That is important. But my overarching feeling when I left that match was, why is it the women's team that are doing that? It is women that are subjected to this, and women will stand with women. But why do we not see this in the men's game? We need the men and male football teams speaking to those male fans. What I would have preferred, what I'm sure women would prefer, is seeing the England men's team not saying that they stand with victims and survivors of sexual violence, but saying that they stand against perpetrators of sexual violence. That makes for meaningful change, and that is the most important message to send. In order to start making that change, in order for men to take a stand, the conversation has to start. And it's for that reason I asked all our male interviewees, who kindly gave me their time to come on this episode, just how did they feel talking about it, and how did they feel taking part?
Completely honest. I mean, I like talking about, I'll happily talk about anything. I don't feel like, I think it's sort of a duty to talk about these things. If I'm completely honest, I don't know as much as I should. And with that becomes sort of an uncomfortable, because I can't say how women feel. I don't know how a woman feels at a ball game, and I never will. So it's uncomfortable in that regard. And so it's hard to talk about something that I can't relate to, but I'll obviously try and emphasize as best I can. But of course, it's just something that everyone needs more education about, and hopefully these sort of campaigns can do that.
Actually having the vocabulary and the skills to be able to talk, and then being in a room of people that question you well, is difficult. Creating a safe environment where people can speak is really important. And I think that can come in a number of ways. That can come from, like you say, role models and men around young men to help them speak about it and to challenge their thinking on certain things. And sometimes it can be women and girls that like the situations they come up with, and actually understanding how a man's behaviour towards them can make them feel and why certain things are safe and not safe. I think those things are key. But the important part to begin with is that you can feel safe in the conversation and comfortable that you say the wrong thing, it's actually not the wrong thing. That's how you learn, right? By going through that. So I think that's really important.
I was incredibly lucky to grow up in a loving household, and my parents got on and still get on great. And I never, like that whole idea of domestic and violence was just so far removed from my existence. So I had no concept of what it was. And so I had this really naive idea of, well, if you're in an abusive relationship, just leave. You know, like really, really basic, stupid view of it. Until I'd actually heard from survivors, I didn't understand it at all. A lot of the reason why people don't talk about it is it's hard to do, right? If I'm thinking about a talk sports show on a Sunday morning and people want to know what's happened in the results before or whatever, people don't actually want to hear, be confronted with that sort of stuff, right? And it's actually not, it's much harder to do that well than it is to just analyze a VAR mistake, right? And so in practical terms, I go, well, I've got a 2-hour show today. What do I want to do? We've got to look ahead to this game. We've got to look back at this. We've got the cricket there. We've got the rugby there. Can we do this? Can we do it justice? How old is the producer? What experience have they got? Do we have legal cover for this? All these things just mean it is much harder to do. I'll give you an example, and I won't name who it was or where it was, but I was, I think it was off the back of the Mason Greenwood story, and I was doing a show and I wanted to talk about domestic violence, and the young producer said to me, it's Friday, not really sure people want to hear that. And you're like, that is shit. But that's sort of what people are thinking. It's the weekend, it's Friday, we don't want to hear about this, you know. And you're like, so I got really indignant. It was like, no, right, if we don't do it, then you know, you can sort of find someone else to do it. And I was filling in somewhere, and it wasn't a regular place to work for me. But it wasn't their fault. Their instant reaction was the culture of, okay, what we're trying to do today is just make a fun show. So why are you bringing the mood down? You know, and I suppose that is a sort of depressing reality of what a lot of people are, you know, who want to talk about it, will find. Someone go, let's just give it 5 minutes. It's a bit bleak, isn't it? You know? And that's sort of depressing.
I hate the fact that it's difficult to talk about. I hate the fact that it's happening. I hate the fact I'm more than willing to talk about it, but I hate the fact I have to talk about it. And I hate the fact that there are women going through that. I hate the fact that this is happening. But it makes me look inside myself as well. I can't sit here and be honest and say, Oh, I'm talking about everyone else and their things. As I say to you, it makes me question myself, my own group, my reactions, whether I have done enough, whether I could do enough, what I can do. It provokes a lot of reactions. But I also think that it's important that these things make you feel these things, because it's important to have difficult conversations. Like, I have difficult conversations about mental health, and people are, the feedback I get is really positive. So if I can do that, and then this can be the start of like me being more vocal about violence against women and girls, and people go, oh, what's that? You go, well, when you walked with me when I spoke about mental health, you walk with everyone when they talk about mental health, homophobia, racism. Let's walk with each other and talk about violence against women and girls. Let's do that. Let's harness the power of those other things. Let's force those reactions to this that we force those. Let's question ourselves. Let's learn. Let's educate ourselves. And let's just do what we can for other people. And how do I know that some of the women that I come across on Saturdays in a less sort of intimately personal role, so the physios, the tea ladies, the secretaries, all of these people, all these women who do incredible work, how do I know that they're not suffering when they go home? And I'd hate to think that they were. And I'd hate to think that they're thinking that, well, this guy's got a platform with 10,000 people and he does amazing stuff for local football. But I'm a woman. I'm part of local football. Where are these people speaking up for me?
That's where we'll be wrapping up for this episode. So firstly, thank you very much to everyone for their contributions and taking their time out to take part in this podcast. And of course, thank you very much to Holly for taking us through all of that so smoothly. We can't cover everything in this one episode, but hopefully it's given people a bit more awareness than before. If you do want to do some further reading or contact anyone to speak about any of the issues raised in this podcast, we put some links in the description for some really brilliant charities and services. We're under the Abbey Stand. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at abbeystandpod, or an email abbeystandpod@gmail.com if you want to send us any questions or remarks. We're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe. Our pods come out every Monday and Thursday, and you can go back and listen to that mental health special if you want to hear the first in the series. Thank you very much for listening, and go well.